Hi, today is June 15th, 2019. This is Mobius Podcast 265. Is that right? Did I get a digit?
That sounds right.
That sounds right. We'll figure it out. Although I think
well,
maybe
we're
it's
getting
like
close.
285?
Oh, yeah, you were way off. 295.
295?
Yeah.
No.
Last week was 294.
No. Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now
okay.
I'm wondering what we talk about at 265.
I don't know, but 295,
265 was last August.
Yeah.
It was post-Hurricane Lane.
Oh, okay. That was a lot of fun.
So, yeah, we're at 295. That's
okay.
A good thing, but one that apparently is sneaking up on us. I don't know what we're planning on doing for podcast 300, but we've got four more to figure out.
Yep, and I think you've got a little bit of... A couple of busy weekends, so we've got a little bit more than 4 weeks to figure it out, I think.
Yeah, we'll have probably a little over a month to get this worked out.
Okay. Alrighty. As John and I were discussing before I hit the record button, we don't have a theme this week. There's no big announcements that I know of. E3, but I'm not a gamer, so, you know, don't really care. John is
I'm
a gamer.
I'm a part-time gamer that I'm just a lousy gamer when it comes to caring about gaming stuff. I play probably at least 2 hours a week of games on my Xbox, but it's purely a social thing to chat with the people that I'm gaming with. I haven't played solo Xbox, just game in probably a little over a year. Mm. So,
and you know, I'm such a poor gamer, poor in the sense of terrible. And maybe a disinterested gamer is that I have an old Xbox. I have a... What came after the original Xbox? Xbox 360?
Yes.
Is that what it was? I have Xbox 360. I don't know how to get my controllers to work again because putting batteries in doesn't help. And there's no cord. I don't think like, there's like a USB option, you know? But anyway.
There's a button on the front.
All right.
To pair. I at least know that. And I also know that Microsoft and their wisdom went from Xbox to 360 to one.
Yeah.
Because that's Microsoft naming in a nutshell.
Well, they also went from Windows 8 to 10, so, you know, there you
yeah.
go.
Yeah. And
arithmetic is not their strongest point.
Yeah. How many different names and modifiers for, you know, other products they've had? Microsoft is the king of adding strange descriptors onto product names.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, so we're just kind of tap dancing because we don't have a lot to talk about.
Well, I do like this first article that you found because I think it's something you and I have both played with, but I don't know how much you still care about it. I don't really care too much about it anymore.
Really? Okay, I want to hear more about this. Okay, so what John is referring to is a New York Times article titled The Sleep Tracker Could Make Your Insomnia Worse. Now, I don't have insomnia. John, I don't think you do either. But nope. I mean, we probably both know people who do, and you know, it's a terrible thing. It's certainly no laughing matter. But what they're saying is that with the article, the gist of it, the two sentences I pulled out is some sleep specialists caution that these apps and devices may provide inaccurate data, and yeah, sure, and can even exacerbate symptoms of insomnia. That's really bad. And then the other thing I didn't know, and John may have known this. There's a name for an unhealthy obsession with achieving perfect sleep. Orthosomnia, which is a really cool sounding word.
It's the act of eating in your sleep, something like that. Orthosomnia.
I guess bones. I don't know.
Yeah, ortho
like orthopedic?
Bones. So the sleep of the bone, I don't know.
I don't know. But apparently, you know, like a lot of things, I mean, you know, John and I have our own little obsessions and various kinds of hobbies and things. So some people are obsessed with getting what they think is perfect sleep, and they believe that these potentially inaccurate apps and devices over their medical professionals. And so, you know, they go to their physicians or whatever and sleep specialists and say, yeah, okay, fine, you know, I did a sleep study and whatever, but my device, my Fitbit says... You know, my Fitbit doesn't measure deep sleep, so I don't know what they're using. But, you know, whatever they're using says I'm not getting enough deep sleep or whatever, and they're kind of, you know, getting bent out of shape about it. And, you know, like I said, if you're really into something, I can understand it. So what do you think, John? I mean, didn't you do something with a Fitbit? I mean, in terms of research, serious research a while back?
Yeah, I did about 4 or 5 years ago. I did a study where we put Fitbits on students, and we actually ran it in the United States, and we ran it in the Philippines, and I have to bother my colleague in the Philippines to figure out what's going on with that, because I have not heard from him in about 2 years, so it might be time to track him down. But anyway, so the irony in what you found is that recently, like very recently, within the past 2 or 3 days, I deleted the Pillow Sleep Tracker app off my phone, which is the app I have been using to track sleep. I hadn't been using it in a while. Probably 2 or 3 months at a time, and then in probably 2 or 3 spurts over the last few years, I would wear something on my wrist at night to get sleep tracking data. So it might be an old Apple Watch, or for a while it was the Fitbit One. The original Fitbit could do sleep tracking. And so I had sleep tracking data off and on for probably the last 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And then finally I looked at it and realized I don't think this thing is useful to me at all, mostly because it seems inaccurate.
Okay.
You know, I can get that my sleep quality isn't that great on certain nights, and it's better on nights I can sleep in, and those sorts of things. That makes sense. But I was to the point where I would wake up and think, gee, I had a pretty good night's sleep last night, feel pretty good, you know, all that. And it would tell me I had like a 60-65% sleep rating, and I thought, well, gee, I don't feel just 10% better than I did yesterday morning when I had a lousy night sleep the night before. So I just didn't find the data all that useful. And I thought, well, if I'm not finding it useful, I'm just not going to bother using it anymore. And it's quite ironic that you posed that these are, you know, potentially inaccurate. Apparently, I didn't care enough for it to bother me.
Yeah.
But there were some nights where I would look at it and go, gee, it's only going to, you know, I'm not going to get any decent sleep tonight, according to my tracker.
No. Yeah, so you're sort of the exact opposite of these orthosomniacs. You know, you kind of look at it and go, it doesn't have sort of, what's the word I'm looking for?
External validity.
External validity, yeah. you know,
yeah, it might not even have good internal validity. Might have no validity at all.
But these people give it extraordinary validity, you know, over and above sleep professionals. So what the New York Times article has this one paragraph or two paragraphs. It says, one cautionary tale. A woman came in reporting that she had average sleep efficiency of only 60%, which is kind of the number you just threw out. According to her tracker. Yeah. She was given medication for restless leg syndrome, tested negative for disordered breathing, I guess that's apnea, and underwent a formal sleep study. So she went, you know, the whole nine yards, right? She wasn't messing around. But after being told that she had slept deeply in the lab, she was not assured. She says, then why does my Fitbit say I'm sleeping so poorly? You know, so she believes her Fitbit more than, you know, the professionals.
You know, I'm just going to say to our five of listeners, if you're one of those people that does this, please stop, because you're ruining it for the rest of us. case in point, so one of the things that we didn't talk about, we had our Super iOS 13 roundup last week.
Yep.
One of the things that we did not mention, because we kind of blew through the Apple Watch segment, was that Apple Watch and iOS 13 can now track women's menstrual cycles.
That's right.
And
which doesn't affect
you
and me.
One of the things that... not directly. But it's one of those things where it's interesting because they have a couple screenshots where they're showing, you know, not just, you know, your period might start this next week or whatever, but also things like your most fertile days are tomorrow and the next day or something like that, because it can, you know, figure out fertility. And I was just shocked that Apple would actually put that out there, because I can see, you know, I assume hopefully you have to agree to 100 different things and say, don't use this. And think it's, you know, life or death. This is exactly accurate. But that's the kind of information that people, if their phone tells them, they might take into account, they might believe much more than their own body, than their own doctors, than their own, you know, external sources. So I really wish that people would start realizing that technology is not perfect.
Yep.
It can give you a good guess. It can maybe be 90% accurate, 95% accurate. But there's always a chance that it's just wrong. So, and I wish those people that counted on it so much would stop, so they don't ruin it for the rest of us. Because I like the idea of having a sleep tracker or a fertility tracker or whatever kind of tracker you have. I don't want it to be taken away from me because some people think it's the authoritative source.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny, right? I mean, there have been a lot of studies on your tendency to believe that something is true or more true, if that's possible, based on whether or not you believe the source of that information is expert or not. And, you know, there have been a lot of studies where, you know, people put on a white lab coat and claim they're so-and-so, and then they, you know, they do the flip, and the same exact person, no lab coat, looks like a slob, gives the same information, and the two different rooms of people have a different view of whether or not that person was telling the truth or not, or was providing expert information. Except now we're putting our trust more in, you know, devices, which I suppose look expert. You know, that may not be a good thing.
Yeah, it's definitely, you have to not believe everything. And also, you can't be on either side. You can't be the cynic on either side of it. You can't say that it's completely accurate or that it's completely inaccurate.
Yeah.
As you and I both know, people are not very comfortable with shades of gray.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and we're not saying they're useless either, because I still use my Fitbit to measure my sleep to give me an idea of, you know, how much sleep I'm getting and so forth. And I know it's not accurate, but it gives me a relative frame, you know, like, this week it says I got an half an hour or more per day sleep than I did the week before. And maybe the week before I was sick, so, you know, it's kind of tossing and turning, that makes sense. But in any case, it's a really interesting article. It's quite long, and I will put it in the show notes. Oh, and it's it seems to be outside of the paywall for the New York Times. The whole thing is available. I don't know if it's those one of those, you know, you can read five articles a month or whatever. But the entire article is outside of the paywall, so I will put that in our show notes so you can click on it and have fun with it. Okay, next up, another. It's not really an article. What do you call this? A report? Pew Internet. You know, Pew Research people. Pew Internet does really great survey research, in my opinion. I really enjoy what they find. You know, what they ask and what they find and their analysis of things. And they do. I think it's either biannual or annual. It might be biannual. Mobile technology and home broadband report. I used to actually have a job where I had to track this stuff, so I used to look at this much more serious. No, maybe in other words, it's seriously. I used to watch it much more often and frequently than I used to. But it's got some really interesting thing, and you know, John and I, even though we're quite a bit of difference in age, we grew up, so to speak, with different phases of broadband accessibility. John, did you ever use an analog modem?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
I did not get broadband. Broadband was not available where I lived until I was 18 or 19.
Okay.
And the majority of my tinkering years were in my early teens and mid-teens, so broadband was sort of a great new thing right about the time I was going to college.
Okay. So you have enough experience with old-school communications to appreciate the difference between, you know, the low-end analog modem and the high bandwidth broadband stuff. We kind of take things for granted. You know, in fact, I've been kind of having a problem with a new TP-Link range extender I bought for my home. And, you know, I was looking and going, man, this thing is only 5 megabits per second download. I would have given the right arm for 5 megabits per second, you know, 20-some-odd years ago. It's quite a bit of difference in what we consider to be at okay these days, you know. But anyway, so there's a couple of things, and so they say that ownership of a smartphone, which is one of the things they ask in this study, because it's mobile and broadband, has gone from 35% in 10 years ago to about 81% in 2019, which is quite dramatic. I mean, I'm trying to remember 10 years ago, so 2009, we were still MVPs, we were still using Windows mobile phones. Wasn't Windows Phone yet, I think. And that to us was smartphone. I guess, well, the iPhone was out 2007. Android came out 2008.
The iPhone was out, but Android was just out. It was still, because I was living in New York at the time.
Yeah.
And I remember being, you know, there were still a lot of reliance on paper timetables to figure out when your train was going to show up. And, you know, a lot more, in the city, obviously, you would see people with smartphones a little bit more than in the suburban area. But still, you had a lot of people that were on what weren't exactly flip phones, but were feature phones. So phones that had a little bit of capability, but not, you know, nothing on the level of a smartphone. No tethering, no, maybe not even real internet access.
You know. Right. It was like,
I remember we still had, it was right after the era of the Danger Sidekick and things like that. You know, feature phones with full keyboards for texting, but they couldn't do internet,
right,
those sorts of things.
And we had like Edge, or maybe even pre-Edge, like what was it called, GPRS or something like that?
We were on Edge, UMTS, and 3G.
Yeah.
But
barely.
Still very spot.
Yeah. In fact, the first iPhone didn't have 3G yet. It was still Edge. Right?
You're right. The first one. The iPhone didn't have it, and then the second iPhone was the iPhone 3G.
Yeah,
and then I had the 3GS, the 4S.
I don't think you were with us at the time, but correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember being in a bus with a bunch of Windows, what we called back then, maybe it wasn't even Windows CE MVPs, it wasn't even Windows Mobile yet. And the Microsoft person who was with us, Derek Brown, and our friends, remember our friend Derek, who was the marketing manager for Windows CE, or, you know, Pocket PC, or whatever it was called back then, pulled out a prototype of the, so this is like 2002, I think, a prototype, or maybe 2001, of the first Pocket PC phone, which was made by, what was it made
HTC.
HTC.
It was the HTC Wallaby.
And we were in wonder because, you know, there he was online as we were, you know, riding down Seattle somewhere in a bus, a little shuttle bus with about, you know, 10 of us in there or something. And we just couldn't get over it, right? It was pretty amazing stuff. It even had a rudimentary web browser. As you might recall, Pocket PC phones did not have a very great web browser. In fact, even Windows Phone didn't have a great web browser, in my opinion. But it was still amazing. You could still get information while you were, you know, wandering around. And this was quite amazing thing to us. But anyway, getting back to the study, there are some interesting things because among the non-broadband users, 45% say they don't have broadband at home. 45% of non-broadband users, not 45% of all people. Because their smartphone lets them do everything they need to do online, up from 27% in 2015. I think I can understand that. I kind of know some people like that. They do everything on their phone. I'm not one of those people. I mean, I use my phone a lot, but I don't think I could get by with just my phone. I don't know, John. You can't even get by without a laptop. Right? You're still traveling with a laptop.
I have students that will try to get by on their
phone. Really?
I try to write whole research papers on their phones. Yes. I have seen it. It is mind-boggling. There are just people out there that they believe that if they can, you know, 95% is good enough. And I can totally see if you had an iPad that you would think, well, gee, I don't need a computer at home. An iPad with a data connection, that might be enough for most people. But yes, I have students that have tried to write papers on phones. They're very mad at me when they can't take certain quizzes on phones because the security software on the quiz doesn't run on a smartphone. It only runs on an actual desktop operating system.
Oh, okay, so I got to ask. So these kids, these young adults, I presume, trying to do everything, trying to write a term paper or whatever it is on a smartphone, are they using a physical keyboard? I mean, like a Bluetooth keyboard? They're literally just tapping it with their fingers.
Tapping it with their fingers.
I wish I had a YouTube video of that.
I don't think, and they don't want to admit that that's what they're doing, but, for example, the way that you can sort of tell this is when you require the actual assignment to have a Word document uploaded.
Okay.
Because, you know, our learning management system allows us to either let students type something straight into the box as, you know, a response to an assignment.
Right.
Or you can require an upload of a media type. But I find that the students, the way I ferret out the students that don't use a desktop operating system are when I require file attachments, when I require a Word document or I require a PowerPoint document or something like that. That's when I get the late night emails of, I tried to go to the computer lab and it wasn't open and I'm going to be late on this, because, you know, they open up their phone at 10 o'clock, the due time is 11, they realize they needed to get to a computer, and then they're out of luck because they were assuming they could just punch it in on their phone. Wow. And the irony is that if they knew more about technology, they could.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And Word do run.
Right.
So that's the ironic part, is that they know just enough to get by in one really horrible situation, yeah, but not enough to get by in another, I guess.
So with a little bit more preparation, they actually could do it all. Although I can't imagine typing an entire term paper on a phone. I mean, I applaud them for trying, but it just seems inefficient to me, you know, from a speed point of view and...
It is somewhat amazing, but it does happen. You would probably be shocked with some of the technology questions I get.
Oh,
because we sort of think, and this is a huge mistake, yeah, that in academia people are making. We talk about digital natives,
right?
And we think digital natives know how to use technology. Well, right, they know how to use what you and I would consider Web 2.0 technology.
Okay,
so using an app, social media, maybe creating, you know, a picture with a filter or something like that in Instagram. Or so if you give them an assignment, for example, that is create an awareness campaign for this issue or something like that, they can figure out how to put that together on their phones or tablets.
Right.
But if you give them something like, I need you to download this file to your computer,
yeah,
and install it, and then navigate to where you installed it, and open up this other file and edit it.
Right.
That is complete freak.
Wow.
The idea of actually installing software, having to find where the... Because I did this one year with a lab component in one of my classes where students had to download some software, install it. I had a supplemental file that they had to, I think, just drop into the directory. It would have overwritten the default file and would have had our customizations for the class in there. And that little bit of effort was enough for me to change the whole assignment here, because it was very frustrating having to tap out on my computer, you know, the same instructions over and over again. Locate my computer on,
right,
your computer.
Right.
Find your drive. Navigate to this folder. So we think of digital natives as knowing how to use technology, but we forget they know how to use Web 2.0. They don't know how to use desktop operating systems or 1.0 type of thing.
Right. So I guess it's sort of like saying we moved from, we moved to automobile natives, people who know how to drive cars, but they no longer knew how to fix them or check their oil or fix a flat tire or anything really significant other than pointing your car in the right direction and getting from point A to B.
That's the analogy that I could think of, where if you did not grow up with an automobile and you got one, you then had to figure out everything about it.
Yeah.
And then the things got too easy. In fact, you still see that with automobiles, because there are things that, you know, I take for granted, like checking my oil, that I,
yeah,
well, doesn't everyone know how to check your oil? And I find out, well, don't.
Because, yeah,
you never had to.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. This is, use an old phrase, mind-blowing.
The other thing that this Pew Internet Research article brought up mind is that the last 2 weeks,
mm-hmm,
I have had friends that have had spotty DSL connections at home, so spotty broadband. We have in our community, you can get DSL or you can get cable. Mostly because AT&T has done a very good job of convincing people that broadband is broadband.
Mm-hmm.
My friends will buy the DSL product that they're offering and get like 3 or 4 megabits per second download, mm-hmm, at the best, versus our cable internet, which regularly pulls 100 to 130 megabits per second.
Yeah.
So in the last 2 weeks, twice I've had people who had the DSL also having our third-party MVNO carrier down here in our region, that's Ceasefire. Mm-hmm. They've been frustrated because they've had spotty internet home broadband and spotty internet on their, you know, third-level carrier MVNO for Ceasefire, and they just switched to cable and Verizon. So basically, you know, go with, they're willing to pay more to get a more stable connection. So I think that's also an interesting thing that this isn't quite capturing, is that there are a bunch of people, I assume, in the next few years that are going to not only care about if they have a connection, but the quality of their connection more so than in the past.
And also a lot of people, because they're non-techies, you know, the people who don't know how to, your students who could have attached a Word doc but didn't because they didn't know how. You know, a lot of little things make a huge difference. For example, I swapped out a wireless access point in my daughter's new condo the other day. And she didn't have a bad one. I mean, it was a couple years old. It had been sitting shrink-wrapped in a box. I just never used it because I didn't need it. You know, it's my backup, my spare. And I just put it in there as a cheap wireless access point. And it was okay. It was fine. But, you know, I figured, well, it is a couple years old, even though it's out of the box. So I'll go buy her a new one, swap it out. Wow. It went her. She went from, I think, about 30 or 40 megabits down to about 150 just by swapping out the access point. Everything else was the same. So, you know, it does make a difference if you're using, you know, if you're just using old hardware or old technology, I should say, on your broadband, you may find out, hey, it makes a difference if you, you know, spend another $50 and get something a little bit newer. I know I was surprised. So I went out and bought the same access point for my house because I haven't changed it in years. Okay, so let's see, what else have we got? Share of broadband services home has risen over 1 year, from 65% in 2018 to 73% in 2019. You know, which goes back to the you know, so that, well, what it also means is 27% of people don't have home broadband service, except for maybe, I wonder if they're counting their phones. I haven't looked at it that closely. But for 92% of households earning $75,000 or more per year, they say they have they have broadband at home. So, but for folks who make less than $30,000 a year, the percentage of those people who say they have broadband at home drops to 56%. So there is kind of a socioeconomic gap in broadband, you know, however they're measuring. 36-point gap is what they're saying. Between those two economic zones. And by the way, in Hawaii, I just saw this article in Hawaii, because, you know, cost of living is so high. And I remember they say 92% of households earning, and so that's, you know, could be two people, earning $75,000. In Hawaii, a individual earning, I think, $71,000 or less is considered low income. So, you know, it kind of depends on where you live. Okay. So differences in income in terms of broadband adoption. Going back to smartphones, 17% of Americans are now smartphone only. I guess some of your students. Meaning they own a smartphone but do not subscribe to broadband internet service at home. This share has roughly doubled since 2013. So it only used to be, you know, say 8%. Maybe 8.5%, 9%. Oh, it's just 8%. It's a little bit more than double. So 17% of Americans... You know, I assume they're meaning like head of household in the census point of view. Say they do not have broadband internet service and just use their smartphone. To me, that's remarkable. That's still remarkable. Let's see, what else have we got? Urban versus suburban versus rural. Kind of what you would think. Rural is, I don't know if statistically more, but 20% of rural Americans are smartphone only versus 17% of urban and 13% of suburban, which I guess kind of makes sense. You would think suburban is probably in the middle class, which gets to that $71,000 mark, although I could be wrong. And of course, age, you know, huge, huge range of ages, 18 to 29, 60% have a smart, well, actually it says a cell phone. And when you get up to 65 plus, it's only 28%, which I find kind of amazing. And an inverse relationship to desktop, laptop, tablet, computer. So they're lumping tablets, you know, desktop and laptop, which is kind of interesting. Do you know students in addition, or the different set from the phone only users who only who go to college with only an iPad or some other tablet, not like a non Windows 10?
I've not seen that, but I can't remember the last time I had a student in the traditional student age range that did not have a smartphone.
Yeah. Fascinating. I mean, I can see the day when, you know, parents are going to send their kids to college with only a tablet of some kind. A non-Windows 10 tablet, I should say, you know, like a Chrome tablet or an iPad or something like that. But I don't know. It's quite a bit. They published an entire report, from what I can tell, and it's quite a bit of information I'm still trying to digest. And it does say, you know, cost is still a big problem, right? So half of non-broadband users today say do not subscribe to broadband because of the cost. It's just too expensive. 31% say the cost of a computer is too expensive, which is sort of interesting because computer prices are now lower than smartphones in many cases. Especially if you consider like a Chromebook to be a computer, which I do. You can get a computer for under $200 now. And by that, I mean like a low-end Chromebook that's still perfectly adequate for many things. 23%. Yeah. Interesting. So, you know, so, and there's pages and pages. This goes on. I'm just reading page one of four so far, so I won't go through the whole thing. But really interesting data, and we'll link the Pew Internet mobile technology and home broadband study thing. You know, something interesting, though, John, is the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, the U.S. government's CDC, used to publish, I think it was either annually or biannually, a telephone, I forget what the official name was, but it was like a telephone availability survey in households. And that's because they were interested in how they could reach citizens for health issues, you know, and for surveys and things like that. And, you know, of course, over the years, they found that there was a shift from wired phone use to wireless, you know, mobile phone use. But I don't know when this happened, but apparently in the last couple of years, they have dropped that survey altogether. I'm not sure it's because of budget or they just think it's not important anymore. But I found that kind of interesting because one of the numbers I remember from about four or five years ago, is that there was an increasing number of households in terms of percentage of households that had nothing, no wired or wireless smartphone. And that was kind of distressing because a number of those had children in those households. But yeah, it was interesting that the CDC apparently no longer conducts that research angle. And I thought, oh, wow, that's a good thing Pew is doing something close to it, although it's not exactly the same. Okay.
It's just interesting to see in our lifetime the morphing of information delivery.
Yeah.
And how people access information. At one time, you know, when you and I were growing up, the idea of not have a phone, if it was available, was just completely crazy. Why would you not? You know, everyone had a phone, assuming that they could get a dedicated phone line, not
right.
a party line or something.
Right.
And, you know, obviously mail was much more important for
yep.
information to worry. And now, I can't remember the last time I found out about something for the first time through a mailer that, you know, was actually delivering me information that I did not have through another source by the time the mailer hit me. So it's an interesting sort of world we're in.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I'm old enough that I remember when those of us here out in the smack dab in the middle Pacific in Hawaii, we used to get our night, I think, let me think if this is true now. I think we used to get our nightly news a day late. You know, the network news from, you know, Walter Cronkite and those kind of people who you may not know of. But, yeah, CBS, NBC, ABC, I think we got our nightly news a day late. Local news was live, of course, so that was not an issue. Also, football games were maybe a week late or a day late or at the very least, you know, still time delayed. And so, I think I've mentioned this before, our sportscasters, we don't have sportscasters anymore, by the way, on our local TV stations, but our local news sportscasters used to have this close your eyes time if you didn't want to know the score before you watched the game on, you know, pre-recorded. So, you know, that was kind of a thing. He says, okay, I'm going to show the scores. I'm not going to say it. Close your eyes. Okay, can you open your eyes now? And I've taken it off the screen. But anyhow, okay. So next, John's got a couple of things. Oh, that's an interesting question.
I have one open discussion I'm curious to get your take on. So okay. I've bought three MacBooks in my life.
Okay.
One of them was my most recent 2015 MacBook Pro that I'm using right now to record this podcast. Mm-hmm. Another is a 2011 MacBook Air, the one that we refer to as the first good Mac Air.
That's right.
It's sitting in my office, my psychology office right now. It's my office computer there. And I have a 2009 MacBook Pro. That was the first Mac I ever owned. And it was, you know, purchased for me when I got a job. It was, you know, here's your company computer, your educational computer. So it came mine after, you know, whatever the expiration on that grant was, and it was 2 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
Where somebody's purchased through grant money and it's just a regular laptop. The government just doesn't care anymore. Because, why, you know, by that point, it's out of date.
Right.
It doesn't work on industrial machinery, though. It doesn't work on, like, if you buy an MRI scanner or something like that. They don't give you that after 2 years. But, so I have this 2009 MacBook Pro sitting over here. It runs Mac OS El Capitan. That's the latest version that it'll run.
Right.
And it runs fairly well. It's got, look at how much RAM it's got in there. It's snappy enough. It's 8 gigabytes of RAM, 2.5 gigahertz Intel Core 2 Duo. It's, mid-2009 MacBook Pro. And it's just sitting here. I don't know what to do with it. I don't really like selling it because it was my first MacBook ever, my first Mac ever.
Yeah.
But I also am kind of something that just sits around doing nothing all day. So what should I do with my old 2009 MacBook Pro?
Boy. Okay. Well, as soon as you tell me what to do with my 2013 MacBook Pro, I'll tell you. I don't know. And I, like I said, I have a 2013 MacBook Pro whose Wi-Fi hardware stopped working. But I, you know, I bought a, I don't know, $10 USB Wi-Fi dongle that brought it back up to speed, pun intended. And it doesn't do much. I just happened to turn it on for the first time in months last weekend, in fact, to, you know, to update apps and things like that. But I don't know what to do with it either. And I don't want to throw it. Well, it's perfectly good. So I'm not going to throw it away. And I don't want to give it away. And it's not worth selling, I think. But I don't know. What are your thoughts? The other thing is these MacBooks are pretty energy inefficient compared to, you know, what we've got now.
Well, and the interesting thing is, you know, 10 years ago, this would not have been a problem.
Yeah.
Well, 15 years ago. And 10 to 15 years ago, this would have been the MacBook or the computer that was sitting next to my bed so I could read at night. Or it would have been next to the couch so I could open it up and read and something like that. It would have just had a permanent location in my house that wasn't my desk.
Okay.
Now all of that is an iPad or a tablet and an iPhone. You know?
Right.
So that was where old computers did used to go. I've thought about it could become, you know, a media server. It could become a test bench computer. It could become a computer for when guests come over, although that, again, also does not happen anymore. When people come to visit, they tend to bring as much computing power as I would bring to their house, you know, at least a phone and an iPad. So I do have my network attached storage unit over here that does a lot of my media sharing and everything else, so I don't really need it for that. It's just it's an interesting problem.
I have an idea.
It's functional.
Okay. I have two ideas. So idea number one is turn it into a Chrome OS machine using something like Neverware's Cloud Ready.
Okay.
I think it's free. If you want to spend some money, you can buy, I think it's Asus, has like a $90 USB dongle that, again, turns it your, you know, without overwriting your SSD or anything, turns your MacBook Pro into a Chrome OS device. And it would allow you relatively cheaply, you know, either free or under $100, to play with Chrome OS to see if it's something to your liking.
That is one possible thing to do with it.
Yeah.
So, I had not thought about that.
So I will put that in our show notes. Let's see, neverware.com. That's what it is, neverware.com. I will put that link in our show notes. And so other people who might be interested can look at it.
The other thought I just had, that I guess I could do, is it could become the emergency bug-out laptop. But I mean, I could put copies of extremely like important files on it. You know, it's got encrypted hard drive. It's got file vault on it. So I could put kind of my most important files on it. And then, you know, if you, I don't have one packed all the time, even though I probably should. I don't know. If you had an emergency readiness kit or something like that, it might not be a bad idea to have a laptop with you if you had to evacuate your house and get out. And maybe your current laptop was not something you could take with you, or you'd left it at the office, or it was broken at that time, or something like that. So I guess that's not a bad reason to keep it sort of ready to go if it ever had to become a backup machine. Because it could easily be stowed and then taken with someone.
Okay. And, you know, I live in a earthquake and tsunami / hurricane kind of zone. So to add to that, for your emergency preparedness kit, I will put in a link to the CDC, again, which the CDC is the U.S.'s Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, their zombie preparedness webpage link, so that if in the event of a zombie apocalypse, you know, where you would need your laptop, obviously, you could have other things too. So there's a whole preparedness thing on how to get ready for the zombie apocalypse, and I will place that in there, in our link, zombie apocalypse, because you know you can never tell.
That is very true.
Yeah. Zombie preparedness. Got it. Just typed it in. Okay.
I have our last bit this week. I have is my tech tip of the week, if you're interested in hearing that one.
I am.
So we've talked about the Pixel a Day thing that I've been doing this last year just to do better at, you know, live tracking or chart tracking or live blogging or daily journaling or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And one of the things back in December when I started doing this, I looked and there were a bunch of apps on the App Store that did this. A lot of them were freemium style apps where you could get the basic functionality, but if you wanted to be able to export your little graphics or whatever it might be, it was more money for that. So I wasn't too thrilled about that. And I had the revelation that all I really needed was an Excel spreadsheet. So sure enough, there's Excel spreadsheets.
Uh-oh, I lost John. Hang on.
Oh.
John, I lost you right after you said something about Excel spreadsheet. Okay.
And right now?
Yeah, you're breaking up. Maybe unplug and replug your USB, if you're using a USB headset. It looks like you're using a Bluetooth headset.
It's wireless.
Yeah.
Let me try just turning my camera off and see if that helps.
Okay.
Does that help at all?
Yeah, it seems to have helped with, maybe we had some bandwidth problems after talking about broadband.
Oh, I respect.
Okay.
So, as I was saying, I found an Excel spreadsheet that to do the tracking. And so I then thought, well, all I need is a way to open this spreadsheet easily.
Okay.
And that's, you know, you think about it, it's like 3 taps, 4 taps if I want to open Excel on my phone and then find the spreadsheet and open it up. But I wanted 1 tap. I wanted just one thing. And I remembered that Siri Shortcuts, which is built off of our old friend the Workflow app that had been around for a few years, you can build a workflow and then have it create its own icon on your home screen. So I thought, well, gee, that would be useful to have a workflow that would open the Excel spreadsheet for me. But here is the problem. Workflow or Siri Shortcuts does not have an action for open an Excel spreadsheet file. It has actions for opening other things, but, you know, most of the time, Apple does not build in actions for Microsoft, and Microsoft doesn't go out of its way to build in the actions either.
Okay.
So I was thinking about this, and then I realized something interesting. When you go to a share link in Microsoft Office, so say someone sends you a share link on your iPhone or iPad, and you tap on it, the operating system is smart enough to realize that it is an Excel share link or a Word share link, and it briefly pops up the web browser and then immediately pops up Word or Excel as soon as it realizes that that's the data that it's bringing in.
Right.
So all I did was I went into Excel, into my spreadsheet, and I created a share link, the kind of link that you would send to someone else to collaborate on your your sheet with you.
Mm-hmm.
I copied that, and then I went to Siri Shortcuts, and I found a template for open a web page. So I copied that in, and I replaced the URL with my share URL. And now when I tap on that shortcut, it immediately opens up the Excel spreadsheet. So in essence, I have an action that is open this particular Excel spreadsheet.
Right.
But it's even more versatile because I can throw any share link I want in there, and it can open any app that supports that URL mapping. So anyone out there that is thinking, I want to use Siri Shortcuts, but there's not an action for open this app or open that app, if that application has a URL scheme, a developer URL scheme where someone can, you know, create a link to open a file in that app, try popping that straight into the open URL action, and you've got yourself an open that app command.
Okay.
It seemed really simple once I figured it out, but also one of those things where you thought, well, gee, why hasn't anyone talked about this yet? I'll put a link in our show notes. I'll grab a screenshot of what my Siri Shortcuts action looks like to get my Excel spreadsheet open. And once you see it, it makes it a lot more easy to understand.
Okay. So now you said you found a template for the shortcuts. Where does one find such a template?
When you go into Siri Shortcuts, so I'm going to open it on my phone right now.
Okay.
You've got your library, and then there's a little gallery tab on the bottom. And it's got a bunch of different gallery options. And I think if I just search open web page, will this work? Open URL, maybe? Yeah, if I just do a search for open URL, there is right there a shortcut for open URLs, open links from input or the clipboard in Safari.
Nice.
So that's probably what I built this off of. But as I said, I'll have a picture, and there's basically just two items on my Year in Pixels Siri shortcut. There is the URL, and then there is the open URLs command, which opens said URL.
You know, and I should note that I didn't ask John about where to find it because, you know, as part of our little pre-written patter, I actually didn't know. In fact, I was telling John, I was telling John before the podcast, I saw that in the show notes, and I said, you know, John, I heard somebody else talking about shortcuts the other day and realized I have no idea how to use it. And in fact, just now, as John was talking, I downloaded the app from Apple, which is called Shortcuts. And so I could kind of follow along as John was saying, well, you know, it's in the gallery. So I tapped on gallery and yeah, sure. There's a lot of stuff there. In fact, it might solve a problem I was just thinking about today. So I have, I don't have the Apple's, music streaming services. I can't remember. Apple Music, I guess it is. I subscribe to Google Play Music or whatever it's called these days for a couple of reasons. But anyway, I do. And so when I download music to, you know, listen to, that's where it goes. It doesn't go into iTunes or whatever it's called these days. So I was thinking, you know, if I had something where, you can't launch Google Play Music from Siri because Siri, you know, doesn't like anything that's non-Apple, as far as I can tell. But I guess with shortcuts, I could, don't you think? Oh, I think
probably.
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like it can launch other third-party applications. I noticed there's one for OmniFocus and a couple other things. So I'm thinking this is what I need. I'm looking forward to it. Evernote, there's some Evernote shortcuts. So definitely looking forward to it. In fact, there's a whole bunch of, there's a whole section of Evernote shortcuts in the gallery, apparently, which is pretty cool. So once again, I've learned something from John, and I will take advantage of it by seeing if I can do something to open Google Play with Siri. Because as you know, as much as I deride Siri, I do generally play media in my car, on my app, my iPhone versus my Pixel 3a, for a whole bunch of reasons. But it's just something I needed to do, and I don't know how to do it, so I will have to learn. Okay, John. Well, once again, we have managed to almost 1 hour from a show about nothing, so, without even trying. We have come to almost a full hour of talking, and we will get back to you guys next time. Thanks as usual, John.
No problem.